Accession number 9423, Reel 4.
Mr. Plimmer, Reel 4. You were describing the trench system at Lewes.
Yes. Most of the trenches were labelled with the signposts telling you the name of the trench and where the latrines were and where the water points were and which was the most dangerous part of the line with regard to snipers. This was important because some of the trenches were in such a position that we could really look into their trenches just the same as they could look into ours. Not the whole length of a trench, but just some little portion where we could enfilade them. And these were the parts of the trench where it was most dangerous to walk, because snipers were always trained on there, and if a man was foolish enough to walk over the upright door, he might get hit. That was one of the points that was clearly marked by signposts, would tell you where to be careful.
Did you see any instances of people being hit by snipers?
Oh, there was plenty of people there. Seen blokes. I was standing talking to a bloke one day, and he's plop, and his head was smashed in like an egg, you know. He was hit in the head, and then brain smashed all over the place. And he wasn't really looking over to. He just happened to be in a place where the sniper from the other trench could get a name on him, you know.
What impact did that have on you?
No, he just got killed. But to me, nothing. He didn't hit me. I wasn't standing in the sniper's line.
Mm. You were with this man when he was hit?
Well, we were in a group together. It wasn't by me, so a group. Yeah.
Could you describe the actual support line trenches and communication
trenches?
Well,
they were similar to the front line trenches. So was the reserve. They were similar. The support line would be about 50 yards or more behind it. And, of course, in front line, that piece of land in front would be the land we call no man's land with its forest of barbed wires. Then between the front line and the support line, there would be an area of probably 50 yards. That too would be adequately, you know, protected with barbed wire and that, so that if the front line did fall, the support line would become the front line, you see. And the same thing obtained with regard to the reserve line. In between the support line and the reserve line, there would be adequate barbed wire entanglements, you see. And all these were connected by communication trenches, so that they could move troops forward to support if necessary. Because, I mean, if the front line was under jeopardy, I mean, the people in the support line wouldn't just wait there until the front line fell. They'd be reinforced, you see, that sort of thing. And they were all, you know, with communication trenches.
So the trench system there was very well established, you say?
Oh, yes. Whereas in the front line there was very little in the way of, say, cooking facilities. Perhaps in the support line you might find a bit of a cookhouse or something like that, you know.
Actually in the trenches itself?
In the trenches, you know, sort of thing. I mean, the man in the support line felt far more secure than the man in the front line, yet he wasn't any more secure at all. But he knew because he got somebody in front of him that he felt a little bit of security.
Was there a system of deep dugouts there?
Yes, at Lewes there was, because it was chalky there. Very, very deep dugouts.
Did you actually go down them yourselves?
Yes, people could live down there.
Could you describe one of the dugouts to me?
Well, a dugout would be going down into a cellar, ordinary steps. Then there would be a great cavern, you know, about what? 10 or 12 feet square or something like that. Then it might have a little passage moving up to another cavern, that sort of thing. And people used to sleep down there. Not all of them, but if they could. They could have a kip down. No beds down there. Just flop down on the floor in the ground sheet. No clothes taken off. Might take your equipment off.
What sort of lighting would be available down there?
Oh, only candles. Might a brazier or something like that. Candles.
They actually had heating down then, some of them?
Well, they used to cook down there occasionally, but on the braziers and that sort of thing. Used to get coke.
Where did he get the coke from?
Well, it used to come up. You could go down the line and get a bag of coke in rations and that sort of thing. Plenty of timber about. Now, you say if you put a soldier in a front line trench, the first thing he'll do is chop it down and make a cup of tea. Yeah.
Where did the timber come from? Was that used for shoring up the trench walls?
Yes, oh man, yes. Well, you see, the trenches were shored up with rabbiting, as they called it, and all that had to be continually repaired. Well, all the surplus wood, that would be firewood, you know.
So, in this particular section of the trenches, the walls themselves weren't bare earth, they were actually covered over?
No, they were revetted, what they called it, revetting with wire.
Could you describe that?
Well, there would be the bare wall, then there would be a two or three pickets stuck in against the bare wall, and behind the pickets there would be this wire netting, and that was supposed to hold the thing in. But of course they get damaged all the time with shellfire, and all the pickets and all the thing would have to be replaced. Well, that would be firewood, and then duck boards used to get blown up. All that would use for firewood.
Was the whole trench had duck boards along the floor, did it?
Well, the trenches weren't in one straight line. They were built on what they call a traverse system. The idea of that was that if a shell burst in a long line of trenches, the blast would be more dangerous than it would if it fell in a short place with the bastion in between. But all the trenches, whatever they were, whatever they could be, they had these duckboards, because you used to try and have a sump on them to try and take away the surplus water accumulated.
Would you say that, although you went there in a very dry period, would you say the trenches were normally well drained?
But I've been in trenches where they've been very badly drained. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some parts of the line there are no trenches at all, like Passchendaele for instance. You can't dig down more than a spadeful of earth before you get to water, so they have to have their defences in redoubts on the top, and people go to them over duck boards. That's where you read about people falling in shell holes. They fall off the duckboards, heavily laden with equipment and that stuff there. And they might try and dodge a shell and go in the water and get drowned. People have been drowned.
Were you ever in that situation yourself? Not being drowned, but in very flooded areas?
I've not been too bad. I've been in places where they've had to do the Sauchi and places like that. But I've not been in Passchendaele.
To return to the trenches at Loos, were you at all responsible for their maintenance or the repair of them?
Well, you had to do that yourself, yes.
What did you have to do?
The daily routine in a trench would be this. If you weren't already on a sentry duty, your day would start before dawn, when you'd be hooked up there to stand to. This is an operation that takes place every morning at dusk, and every morning at dawn and every evening at dusk. It's a time when the people in charge think that the enemy might be more advantageously attacked. They wouldn't attack in the dark on account of the fact that they might not find a way. And if they attacked in broad daylight, well, they'd make themselves sitting targets for the machine gunners. So at dusk and dark and a half light, you know, in the dawn, they think that's the most likely time. So they take this precaution of everybody manning their battle positions. Germans do the same, by the way. And then when the panic's over, you go about your work. The day's work might be, well, there might be a roll call, an inspection. There'd be work to be done. People would be detailed for sentry duty. Some would be detailed to go and bring rations at the time or go for water. There'd be digging to be done, trenches to be repaired, sandbags to be filled, ammunition to be replenished, machine guns to be cleaned, all that sort of thing. Sentries to be posted.
Perhaps we could look at some of those things in a little bit more detail. Say there was roll call there. Who would do the roll call?
Well, the officer in charge would go around and just make sure everybody was there.
So he'd actually do the moving around, looking at each individual,
yes,
rather than...
He wouldn't have much. I mean, a platoon of about 50 men would have about 100 yards of trench as their responsibility, the front line. He'd have about 100 yards of front line. And the reserve people too would still be in this 100 yards, and so are the support people. So this officer and the NCOs would go around this 100 yards and, you know, make sure everybody was alive, that sort of thing. And then, as I said, they'd all be detailed for work. And when everybody was detailed for work, you'd probably find...
Before you go on to... Sorry to interrupt you. Before you go on to work, you also said that there would be inspections. What would that actually entail?
Well, it would only be making sure that everybody was there.
Did they inspect equipment to make sure
no,
it was...
No, never like that. You mean to say they were clean?
Yeah.
No. They used to inspect your rifles, say that they were workable, and the machine gunners would clean our guns, not all together, one at a time, so that they wouldn't all be out of action at the same time. Then people would do any job that's required. So I should think that about a third of the people might be for sentry duty, and about a third working, and about a third resting or sleeping, something in that proportion. Mm-hmm. But not ordered in that way, but that would probably be about that. Those people who are resting would try and get a bit of sleep somewhere, or, you know, go down the dugout and have a rest, or they might play cards, or read, or keep alert, that sort of thing.
That's what you did when you were on rest?
Yes. No, everybody's doing that, but when you're not actually doing any work in the trench, you'd do that, you know. You'd find time to do that. But if he was on a working party, well, you'd have a job to do.
Can you describe some of the jobs you would do on a working party? For example, were you ever on a wiring party?
That's mostly done at night time. Wire would have to be brought up, you know. You wouldn't go out in the daylight and do any wiring because you'd be caught in death. But if the wire was damaged in front, you'd know that by the use of the periscope, you see. People look through periscope, you'd see that the wire was damaged. Or if you was going to make a raid, you see, you might think, well, I'd like our men to go through there, so at night time somebody would go out and cut a passage through the wire. But you'd have to do that. You'd have to bring up wire, bring up stores. Because when a man goes into trenches, he usually carries a lot of equipment with him, besides his own equipment. A roll of barbed wire or bag of bombs. If there's anywhere anybody can hang anything onto you, they'll do that, you see. That's the way they get the stuff up the line, you see. Mm-hmm. So if the line gets damaged in the night time or in the daytime, and it's got to be repaired, well, the people who are in the line, they've got to get on with it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the REs come up and it's a bit complicated and you do a little bit of work.
Were you actually on a wiring party yourself?
At night. Never been on a wiring party, but I've been out on patrol.
Oh, well, perhaps you could tell me about being out on patrol.
Well, being on patrol is an operation which takes place occasionally. Sometimes in areas it might take place every night, but I don't know whether they do or whether they don't. But I've been out on one, although machine gunners never really do this sort of thing. But on this particular occasion, we were in a position where somebody thought that if they could get a machine gun at a particular point, they could enfilade the enemy fire. So one night... This was during a raid, not a patrol. They made a raid on the enemy lines one night, and they took this machine. Me and my mate took this machine gun out, and we stuck this machine gun on this pot and emptied a couple of belts, what we thought would go into the enemy, you know, enfilade.
You say you took the machine gun out. Was that actually out in front of the British front lines?
That's right, yeah. We took a machine gun, but not a tripod, but on what they call an auxiliary tripod, a little tripod that's fixed to it, you see. And we went out with this raiding party, and we went to this particular spot, a little bit of a hummock, where somebody, with the use of a map and clinometer, thought that that was a place where we could fire into their line. We went in there and we fired at this place, and that was the only time I ever went out. But people
Can you tell me what your reaction was to actually being out in no man's land with a machine gun?
Well, I wasn't alone. There were other people. There was a platoon of infantry out there, about 30, 40 or 50 more infantry. They'd gone on in front to raid the enemy trench. What they were after, I don't know. They might have been gone out to silence a machine gun, or to be nasty, just throw bombs down their dugouts, or to capture a prisoner. But while this operation was taking place, the powers that be worked it out that we could do that. And we just went out there and put a couple of belts down while they were making their noise at the front, and then come back.
I see. So how did you make sure that you avoided shooting your own men if they were in front
of
you?
Well, we were firing sideways, you see.
Oh, I see.
So sideways. The trenches are not all in a straight line. They cover the contours of the land. As I say, some are high and some are low. Some are in rock, some are in marshland. Different type of terrain, you see. But this was what you might call a one-off situation that might happen. I don't know that it ever happened before or whether it was successful, but an ordinary patrol is just two or three people creeping around on their bellies in the night, lightly armed, trying to find out what's going on.
Yeah, did you actually ever do that?
No, the infantry used to do that.
Can you think of any other particular duties that you had?
Well, we used to do, in the machine corps, we used to do what they call night firing. Every time a bloke went on duty, he always used to let off a few rounds through his belt, you know, or belt, I mean, in hope of cutting some. But they used to have organised night firing. An officer would come round during the day, and he would set his gun sights on a map reference with clinometer, and then at some time during the night, on a given signal, about a dozen or more guns would open up, fire a couple of thousand rounds out at the, not know what they're firing. It might be a Russian dump. They might have thought they were firing at a working party, but that used to happen regularly at night time, night firing. That's when we used to fire through the wet blankets so that we wouldn't give away the flash. That was apart from the ordinary firing at night time, which we used to. They used to fire. They used to be regularly sweeping our trenches, you know. Mm-hmm. You've seen that film where that fella, he never got out of the trench, did he? He went down, well, he was caught by that fire of,
machine gun. So you alternated between special night firing and just generally sweeping from side to side?
That's right, yes. We should do every night sweep from side to side.
Was there any specific time interval between doing that?
No, you could do it all night if you wanted to. We used to let them go, have a few, and then about a quarter of an hour later, and blow up another go. Fire anywhere, loosely, you know. Gun was set, fire anywhere. Or fire overhead or nothing. But these organised night shoots were specific things.
And you were given specific, presumably, targets to aim at?
Well, we didn't know what target it was. Mm. We were firing on a map reference by using a clinometer, you know, a thing that measures angle. You know,
yes,
what they are, don't they? And that used to take place very often.
Did you fire a machine gun during the day?
Not at any particular time. We used to fire at random, like the Germans did. Yeah, random. We never saw the Germans during the day. We never set eyes on them. First Germans I saw was in the march. I never saw another one afterward until the big attack in August when we went toward the Hindenburg line. The rest of the time they were in the trenches. We didn't see them. They never saw us unless we were foolish enough to look over.
So at times like Stand 2, where there'd be sort of general...
Well, you never see anybody.
No.
No. All the while I was at Lewes, they never attacked once. I was at Lewes about 3 months. They never attacked once, but I know we attacked on two or three occasions. The one occasion when me and my mate went out, and then on other occasions, we used to give them overhead fire. You see, in the morning and at dusk, when these people Stand 2, they're there to repel an attack. So when our people made an attack, they would run into the enemy fire. So they had to have some assistance. And the assistance would come from the artillery, who would lay down a barrage on the enemy trenches, and from the machine gun corps, who would fire overhead, like the guns do, into the back area of the Germans, to try and catch a few reinforcements coming up. Well, we would put down a barrage, and so would the artillery. And then at a given moment, the barrage would lift and the raid would take place. And that's how we used to help them. Twice we did that.
Now, could you describe that then, what you actually had to do in terms of the amount of machine gun fire you supplied?
We know there were a raid taking place, and we know that we'd have to fire overhead at a certain time. The artillery would be started probably, and when the artillery would start, we would probably start the same, and we'd just fire overhead. The idea was to keep the enemy away from the machine guns, you see.
How often would you fire?
All the time. Or continuous firing might go on for about a quarter of an hour or something like that, continuous firing until you got the order.
And what movements did you make with the gun?
None at all. Just fired fired up into the back area. You sweep it a little bit, but...
Well, you moved it from side to side?
Yeah, no target of any kind. Just overhead firing to keep the enemy away from the trenches, you see. And then when you got the signal to do so, you'd lift your sights and our people would go forward.
What would be the signal?
Well, officer might blow a whistle or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other types of signal that you would expect to hear?
The only ones I know were signals and rifle shots or revolver shots or something like that. A couple of revolver shots simultaneously. perhaps there might be a signal or something like that.
You weren't connected by telephone to anyone?
There were telephones, yes. We never had a telephone. Telephones would be to company headquarters, battalion, platoon headquarters, you see. Mm-hmm. That would be another thing. People might make a raid with the object of laying a telephone out or something like that. And then somebody would go out there and telephone back. That's some sneaky little dodges.
I don't quite understand that. What do you mean? Where would
If they were going to make a raid, mm-hmm. they'd have to prepare for it, you see. They'd have to go out and be trained for it. They'd know exactly what you've got to do. The people who were going to make this raid would go out to a training area where the whole trench system would be taped out, and they would know exactly what they got to do, where they got to go, and where everything was. Well, some people, before the raid would take place, would go out and cut wire so they could get through. And some people might go out to lay a telephone so that the chap on the raid could telephone back. That sort of thing. That's happened. Yes, that's...
That's interesting. Did you actually know of an instance where that happened?
It's weird. Yes. They used to have listening posts, too. Out from the front line, about 20 or 30 yards, would be a little trench with a chap in there, and he would listen. He could hear in the dark, you know, and that sort of thing, you know. Listening posts.
You were ever involved in anything like that yourself?
The infantry used to have that listening post. I was in the machine gun corps. My mob were defensive, you know, defensive. I don't think many machine gun corps people ever took part in actual raids at all. They may have done, but they took part in the attacks when the big attacks took place. They went there.
Okay, thank you very much. Perhaps we could turn now just to a description of the sort of routine fighting, what you might expect to face whilst you're in the front line there.
Well, you could expect to be shelled any time. Any moment of life, you could expect to be shelled. And you've got very little protection against that. The only protection against shellfire is a deep dugout. You can be in a little place, a shelter, whatever. Shell hit the shelter, it would take the shelter as well. So the only defence you've got against artillery is the dugout. But you can get defence against a machine gun because they usually fire level with the ground, so you can keep down. You've got very little defence against a trench mortar. They are great big things. They're something like a bomb. They're not fired from a gun. They come from a howitzer. This howitzer throws the thing right up in the air in a very peculiar trajectory. And it stops up in the air. It must stop at some time, and it just drops down anywhere. Not like a shell. Mm-hmm. A shell will take a true path, mm-hmm. a true trajectory. So you've got these things. You haven't got much protection against them. When one of them goes up, you've got to get out of the way. Then you've got gas. You can get gas any time, particularly at the end of the war. The Germans used high explosive shells to put gas in, so we could get gas any time.
Yes, just to stay with the shells for a moment, did you learn to distinguish between the different types of shells?
Well, there were people who could distinguish them. You could do, but it wasn't much use. I mean, the one that was going to get you, you wouldn't know anything about it. It was the one that the sound travelled faster than them. You could hear them coming, and you'd know at some point that it was going to miss you.
How long did it take you to learn to distinguish these different sort of sounds and know where the one's coming in close?
I don't know. I couldn't give you a figure on that. You might be in a line and never hear a shell for a week, and you might be in a line and watch it all day. They had big ones and small ones. The small one used to make a whine sort of thing. The bigger ones made a bigger rumble. And if you could get the idea that it was going to miss you, but if it was going to hit you, you got it before you knew. And it would blow you to bits.
What effect do you think the shelling had on you personally? How did you react
very
to it?
Very frightening, I can tell you. I mean, you see people blown to little bits. I've seen people... I actually have to put a man in a sandbag, you know. I mean, you could get killed by the blast alone. And then all the shell fragments, some people actually get hit by them.
Can you think how it affected you yourself? Did it?
Well, as I say, we took it all in our stride. We knew what we were in for. We didn't give it a great deal of thought. We were in the trenches. We wondered when the war would be over. We didn't like it there. We wished it would end. We didn't have any particular feeling. I had no attitude towards the bloke who knew the trench. Mm. I didn't care two oats about him. I never saw him. I didn't care about his character or conduct at all. He was there the same as me.
Mm. Would you say that was an attitude shared by all British troops?
Well, people's attitude varied a great deal. There may have been occasions when a unit had been very badly treated and they might have been out for some sort of revenge, and they would probably behave more viciously towards the enemy than otherwise. Some of the units were very mild. The Scots were the worst. I think I said that before, didn't I? The Scots were the worst. But generally speaking, my attitude to the Germans was non-committal. I didn't feel much about it. Mind you, I didn't hate him. I probably loved him enough to shoot him if I got a chance. But if I shot him, I wouldn't shoot him with any hatred in my heart. I'd shoot him because I was conditioned to do so. And also, bear in mind, if I didn't shoot him, he'd probably shoot me. But when it come to attitudes, I don't think I had any particular bad feelings towards them. I knew that they were in the same position as we were.
Could you give me some description of the effects of the fighting on yourself?
Well, the effects of this sort of thing would be individual, of course, wouldn't they? I've never really been in a position as, like some people have been in far, far worse positions than me. I mean, some of these infantrymen who were continually going on raids and all that, they had it worse than we had, much worse than we had. They must have felt a lot of fatigue. They had awful jobs to do. I mean, they would have to bury the dead, carry the wounded down the line. They would have to do jobs that we never did in the machine gun corps, because we weren't actually separate from them, but we were under a different organisation. We shared their difficulties. We shared their shells and bombs and gas. But we didn't do the work that they did. They had their own particular job to do. The riflemen used to man the frontline fires, but we had our own positions, you see. So actually speaking, we were a little separate from them, and our attitude was probably less than theirs. But their attitude must have been terrible, because I said the things they had to do, they had to cope with all the misery of the trenches, bury the dead, carry the wounded down there, and probably be much more alert than we were, you see. Mm. Because what we had to do, we were in a defensive role more, but they were could be called upon to make an attack and all that sort of thing.
Yes, but nevertheless, the shelling must have been fairly indiscriminate between you and the infantry.
Well,
and
we
the
shared the shells with them, yes, of course. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Did you see think that affected you or the people you worked with at all?
What, the shelling?
Well, just the general fighting, fact that you could go for days without being shot at.
It didn't affect me very much, because I wasn't sufficiently up in the ways of the world. I was only a kid, like other blokes there. It was more of a great big game that we enjoyed, apart from the actual shelling and all that sort of thing.
Did you see any evidence of shell shock or just collapse of nerves because of the situation?
Well, I can't say that I've actually seen a lot of it. I know we used to have a man on my gun, but he wouldn't move an inch. He wouldn't go for rations. He wouldn't do a thing. He was absolutely sure he was going to get killed. But he never. He never got killed. But he always knew he was going to get killed. He wouldn't go down for rations. We used to, at night time, because going down to rations meant you went to a rendezvous, which was probably under enemy fire. He would never go. He used to do anything but go. And he was what you might call the windiest man I ever knew. We knew he was going to die, but he never died. He never got touched.
What was the attitude of his colleagues to him?
Well, they just tolerated him. They didn't regard him as being a coward. They understood how he felt, they realised that it could happen to them, that sort of thing.
But didn't they resent the fact that someone had to go instead of him?
No, they didn't do that, no. He used to do other things instead,
What did he do?
Well, he'd probably do an extra sentry go or something like that. Yeah, remember him.
Did you come across any sort of instances of desertion or self-inflicted wounds, things like
that? No, I never in my unit. although I do know of people who have been shot, we've heard of them. When it was at Relouz, there was a town behind there called Le Brebis, and there was a military police station there, and I've heard that people have been shot there. I think at the time I was there, the military police used to shoot them, but at one time they used to be men of their own unit who used to shoot them, but I think at the time when I was there, the military police used to do it. I've never known of anybody being shot.
Do you think it was a fairly rare occurrence?
Oh, could have been, I mean.
You didn't know at the time?
No.
Could you tell me what your attitude to the deserters was?
Well, I was never ever involved in such a thing. Nobody in my unit ever deserted, to my knowledge. Nor had they deserted previously to my being there, although they may have done, but I didn't know anything about it.
Was it ever discussed?
No, never discussed. I've seen people...